this is like just a weird thing about me, but I love digging, and snow shoveling is kind of like the same thing for me. And so I was actually really excited to go out yesterday and like have to clear the driveway and stuff. And I have these like huge, ridiculous snow boots that are rated for temperatures like far beyond anything that we will ever see here, and they're so large they look like astronaut boots. And so combined with my ridiculous love of digging and getting to wear a ridiculous outfit while I'm doing it, I had such a good time yesterday shoveling the snow off the driveway. So
you don't have to look forward to snow to shovel. You're an adult, you can shovel anytime you want. What have you been digging up lately, Nash?
I've just been digging around in the code for my Pebble music engine lately. So
I love digging in code. What kinds of things have you found in there?
Well, I guess technically I've been adding stuff more than I've been really digging.
So the opposite of digging, got it.
Yeah, it's, I've been burying.
Welcome, everyone, to the Flyover Indies podcast, where Kansas City area game developers talk about what we're playing, what we're making, and what we're learning. And just by listening, you are a part of the game development process. I'm Caleb J. Ross. I'm a member of Flyover Indies, and I'm a game developer. And joining me today are Charlotte Tribble, co-founder of Flyover Indies and also a game developer. Charlotte, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Fantastic. And also, first time on the show, long time in the Flyover Indies, Nash High, member of Flyover Indies, musician and a game developer. How are you, Nash?
I'm doing pretty well. Yeah.
Good. Man, I'm glad you're both doing well.
Yeah.
Because today's episode is one that could either allow us to continue being well or could make me personally very angry at how dumb I am because it's... I don't know. I'm excited about it. I'm bearing the lead here. We're going to talk a little bit about procedural generation, a thing that I know very little about, but I have opinions about, which makes it very dangerous for me to be here. So hopefully I'll learn a little bit of something about that, but that's going to be our main topic. We're going to talk about procedural generation and how that's used in games and examples of it and get all into it and stuff like that. I'll definitely be playing the role of the, playing a role of the ignorant antagonist, just really folding into that fake fantasy in which I know nothing about this thing. But what we're going to do first is we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been playing, as we always do. We're going to talk about what we've been playing and what that's kind of been teaching us a little bit about the games we make and how we approach games and things like that. And it's just fun to talk about the games you've been playing. So I would like, if I could, to start with Charlotte, if you're good to go for it. What have you been playing and what sort of has it been teaching you about game design and development and all those sorts of fun things?
So I've been playing a bunch of stuff lately, which is good for me because I don't normally get as much time as I would like to play games. And I have kind of landed particularly on Valheim over the last like week or so. If you're not familiar with it, it's like a survival crafting exploration type game where you play as Vikings. I play online with my friends, so it's a multiplayer thing. We have a server together, and it's so much fun. And something that we've talked about a few times that we appreciate about this game is the music. Because this is something where it's really easy to go in there and spend quite a bit of time like gathering resources, building a longhouse because it's Vikings, trying to fill out your map and explore for others. Like you're just spending hours in the game oftentimes. And so having music in the background that like supports that has been pretty nice, and multiple times people have commented like, oh my god, the music is so good and chill, and it really is just essentially making me want to continue doing this. And there are other similar games that I think do a really good job of this, like Minecraft is another easy example because it's got tons of the same kinds of gameplay elements as well as mood music that is really well suited for that kind of gameplay. And so my my general takeaway has just been like, you know, it's an obvious one, but I'm not a music person. And so like thinking back to what kind of game it is that you're making, what sort of like feelings are you trying to evoke? And if this is something that you either want people to, or could see envision people like spending quite a bit of time in it and just sort of like essentially hanging out in your game, like definitely put a lot of thought into the music and try and, you know, get something that will support that and just kind of help people flow state while they're playing. They'll probably stay in there longer and have a really good time.
I'm unfamiliar with most sort of these survival type games. They're not really my thing, but I know that you were a fan. And so is chill music pretty common with those, or are there examples where a survival game that you're supposed to sort of get lost into has music that is more upbeat and maybe offensive in a way to the senses of needing to kind of relax and go with the flow?
I don't know if I can think of any examples offhand. If Nash can think of any, because I know like you've played plenty of Minecraft as well, and maybe have other, like you're more of a musician than I am for sure. But I would think that if you are working on a survival game that is more survival heavy and less focused on like, you know, having just sort of a peaceful, mellow time with it, like if the survival aspects are a bit more like dread-inducing, like it's a scary survival game essentially, then I would see you would want to shift the tone of the music to match something like that. But with something like Valheim, it's generally not that scary. I mean, it has plenty of scares in it, don't get me wrong, but the times where we've commented like, oh my gosh, the music is so great, it's been something, you know, we're hanging out in the middle of plains or chopping down trees in a forest, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, that's interesting. Because, well, I have played Minecraft, but I don't know that I've played that many other, like, big open world survival games. So I'm not, like, I can't think of any that do have, like, a more exciting music. But it does seem like you would want, like, you know, during combat, like, to have some more intense combat music, which Minecraft doesn't. And in fact, I was thinking,
true,
like,
yeah,
Minecraft is really quiet most of the time. It's like kind of during transitions that you hear short musical pieces.
Yeah, it's definitely background music, especially with Minecraft. Yeah, but music is important. It really helps set the tone and atmosphere for a game. And yeah, if you're like me and you would never call yourself like a musician or a composer, definitely don't forget about it. Like, talk to your musician and composer friends and, you know, get some good appropriate music into the game. It can help. Yeah,
it's interesting because sound in general, not just music, but really any sound, I know when I make games, it's always the last thing I include, but it is the thing that when you add it, it changes things generally for positive, in a positive direction, the most dramatically. Like, just adding footsteps to a character walking all of a sudden changes things in such a dramatic way. But it's also, in some ways, it feels unfair to relegate music and sound to the last thing. But at the same time, it's also sort of almost by necessity something that does need to come kind of at the end, after you have a good understanding of what exactly you're presenting to the player and how you can enhance that. And so it's weird to save such an important thing for the end. This isn't to say that you can't have musical themes in mind or musical motifs in mind when building out the games. I know I'm probably going to get the developer wrong, or I'm probably going to get the source wrong here, but I believe it was Todd Howard at Bethesda who said that they start every game with music. They begin with music, even though they don't actually implement music until late, but they always have sort of a soundscape to get, like an audio mood board kind of thing, to get all the developers and designers kind of in the right direction. So they incorporate music at the beginning. It's just not tactile until the end, which is kind of an interesting concept, that it's always there, but it's not really there until the very end. And I don't know, it's a strange concept, but enjoyable to think about. All right, let's move on to Nash. You've been playing a brand new game, right? Like something that's really the world has never seen before. And so I'm interested to know what this thing, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Is it chice?
That's close. It's just chess. Yeah. I think it might be game of the year for 2021. I'm not sure. It was really good though. But no, yeah, I had a friend who was just inviting people to play chess with them on chess.com. So I made an account on there, and chess.com is kind of intense. If you do like a computer versus computer game, or like you're playing against the computer, it will rate every single move you make. It'll tell you like, oh, you messed up. You messed up big there.
Oh no.
It's like super judgy.
Yeah, it'll tell you everything. It's like, it's really cool. But yeah, it's also just been fun to play some chess again. It's also like the thing that I've been thinking about in the game design sense as I play it is just how cool the pawns are. Because you probably are familiar enough with chess to know that the pawns, you can move one space forward except for your first move, which you could do two if you wanted to. But they can only capture in a diagonal, like forward and over, which means that they get stuck all the time. They're just like constantly getting stuck, and then they get in your way. And so it's like the whole middle of the board, you really have to think about where you want to put all your pawns and where your opponent is putting their pawns, because that's actually going to be like the whole landscape of the battle for like the middle game and then toward into the end game. And it's just really cool because this very simple like variation in their movement behavior makes them this like absolutely crucial part of the game.
Huh. Yeah, it's been a really long time since I've played chess, but I've never really respected pawns very much. And now I think you've changed my perspective on it. Like, I definitely see them more as, like, little mobile walls or somewhat. They're like Roombas that can't turn around, but still.
Yeah, no, I was the same way until I started, like, for a while, several years ago, I was like, I think I didn't have internet at the time. So, like, a lot of times I would just, like, pull up my computer's chess program and just play it and just get beat over and over again. I think I finally won one time on the easiest difficulty setting, and I was like, oh my gosh, I did it.
Those chess AIs are so difficult.
And, oh my gosh.
Even if you
they
do
are.
Put them on lower ones, it's like, oh my god.
Although I will say, chess.com, they have some good AIs. Like, it's a lot more than just, like, you know, how many moves ahead is it thinking. I think they really spent some time on like trying to make these AIs feel natural, which is pretty cool.
I wonder if they have different AIs that they've given like personas to.
They do. They have like characters.
This is the really rambunctious chess AI. Watch out for this one.
I love thinking about the pawns too in sort of the real life corollary of the battlefield, because I just imagine a bunch of like inept infantrymen like doofuses in the middle of the battlefield, holding their guns, like, what? And all their like comrades are trying to get around them, and they're just kind of spinning around, like, unknowingly, what's going on, guys? Not to denigrate infantrymen in the military, but it's it's crazy. I'm terrible at chess. Always have been terrible at chess. I never plan to play it ever again, so you didn't sell me on this chice game.
Oh, well, that's okay. You know, there are other games out there.
There are. In fact, one I can talk about right now. That's a lovely segue that I just, hopefully you were teeing that up and I didn't just rip it.
Oh, yeah.
Rip the momentum from you. So I've been playing a game called Nier Replicant version number. I don't know. It's a remake of Nier Replicant, and it's the creative director or the lead person, I guess, Yoko Taro, is a weird, strange dude. Although I love everything that he does, he's just weird as heck. The name of this game has a whole bunch of version numbers to it that are part of the official game name, but I can't remember. There's like 17 numbers or something at the end of it. But this is the first, I think it's the first game. There's a weird sort of history with all of the chronology of the games, but I believe this is a remake of the first Nier game, which in some areas was called like Nier Gestalt. Some places it was called, I think, just Nier, or maybe Nier was a separate game. But anyway, the point being, it's a Nier game. And the most famous of the Nier games probably is like 2018's Nier Replicant. 2017-18 came out, Nier Automata. But anyway, they're fantastic games. But the reason I wanted to talk about this game is because it's further showing me the importance of character movement when it comes to games that involve characters, where you play as a character. Like last episode, I talked a little bit about Sackboy and how it was Sackboy: A Big Adventure was kind of a terrible game in terms of movement. And I think that was one of the primary things that really pulled me out of the game and made me not enjoy it so much, is that the character movement was just so bad. It was slow. It was sluggish. But this was a game that was supposed to be fun and exciting, and it was full of color, so you wanted to explore everything and do everything, but you just really couldn't. The character movement itself kind of hindered that. Nier Replicant is almost the opposite, in that it's a big, empty world, like really kind of empty and sort of a bad way, especially considering how big and vast and populated modern open world style kind of games are. This is an open world, mm-hmm. but it's closer to open world than, say, like a corridor shooter or something like that. Okay. It's big and vast and just really empty, like super duper duper empty, almost offensively empty. But your character moves very quickly and is very nimble, and just movement itself is such a fun thing that I could probably have spent a few hours just in a big empty default Unity space and played around with this character movement. It's just that mm-hmm. fun to move around. And so I put, 20 hours into this game and would have gladly put more because I was having so much fun. Whereas with a game like Sackboy, I had trouble putting in 8 hours, even though mm-hmm. Sackboy was a much more populated world and a much more fun environment, at least it should have been. And I think it really boils down to, with Nier Replicant, the character is, it moves very, very nimbly, but you're always in control of the character. So it'll turn. If you're going forward, you press left or right, or any of the infinite directions between. It's an analog stick kind of movement. Your character will go from one angle to another near instantly, not entirely instantly, but near instantly, with a little bit of blending between the animation. Blending just subtle enough to make it important, but you can't really visually see the blending. It'll move very quickly, the character will, and it feels really satisfying. The camera itself is following the character in a cool way. The character run animations, which there is essentially idle, run, and run fast. The run animation affords this sense of forward momentum and speed that Sackboy just didn't have. Mm-hmm. Sackboy, you press forward and the character is still sort of completely vertical, standing up. There's no like leaning into the speed to run. But with the Nier games, your character's almost completely bent 90 degrees at the waist and like horizontal, like it feels fast. You're like, wow, this character's moving fast. And that's just so much fun to play around with. And the combat's great too. I mean, that definitely helps mm-hmm. out when there's cool combat going into, which Sackboy just did not have. So I don't know. It's fun. It's interesting because there is such a delicate balance between going from a idle state to a running state that quickly, but not too quickly. I compare it to a game like The Witcher 3, which is a game that I tried. I eventually did complete it, but many times before I tried to play and just couldn't get into it. Fell off of it within a couple of hours. Like, everyone said it was the greatest game ever, and I'm just like, I don't understand why people think this, because I can't get into it. When I finally realized the reason was because the character movement was so bad. It was just too quick. You press left and you're immediately like turning, and it's jarring, and there's no fluidity to it. I learned that there is an option in the menu to sort of change that, which mm-hmm. helped me out personally quite a bit. But it was too quick, and so it's such a delicate balance. And as I think about my next project, or the thing that I'm trying to learn a lot about animation and movement to create something that has a character, I'm realizing that what I'm going to have to do is, step one, before I even build a world, before I build anything, is like, I've got to make sure this character is fun to move around in a big empty space.
Yeah.
That's 100%. I have to make that work, and if I can't, there's no use in doing anything else.
I totally feel that. I've had that with games before where I've noticed, like, hey, the movement feels really good here, I need to try and emulate this. Hades is another one where I immediately right. was like, oh yes, moving around it feels very, very satisfying. And I think that getting things like, it's often going to be movement, right in your game is super important, because if you think about it, it's like how people tell you should get a good mattress. You're going to spend so many hours of your life sleeping in your bed. If you have a horrible mattress, what are you doing? Like, you're going to have an awful time doing something that you're doing so much of. And for movement in games, that is often going to be something that you're spending a significant amount of your time doing, even if you're simultaneously like doing combat or whatever else, you're still moving. And if you don't get that right, people are going to bounce off your game and it's not going to be satisfying, and you won't have that, like, I'm just having fun moving around. Yeah, get the basics down.
If I had all the time in the world, one of the things I would love to do is set up an A-B test sort of experiment where I have this humanoid character with a movement script and a non-humanoid with a movement script, and the scripts themselves remove variables such as, like, arm movement, leg movement stuff. It's really just sort of, you know, horizontal plane movement and everything, and just use the exact same script, modify the animations only enough to sort of imply certain movements in certain directions and things like this, but essentially make them kind of the same and just see how players feel about the movement. Because part of me feels like the very nature of a character, of humanoid type characters being humanoid, means that there's already a sense of expectation from the player, because we as players are humanoids. We understand how our bodies work, how they're supposed to work, how they're supposed to feel the locomotion. Like, you just intuitively know that. And so I project that on a humanoid character in a way that maybe I wouldn't on, like, a blob. Mm-hmm. And so would I be more forgiving? Would I rate the blob movement higher than the humanoid character movement, even though they're kind of, they're mm-hmm. using the exact same script and again, the animation sequences are just similar kind of thing. I don't know. It'd be really interesting to think about, because I do wonder, as I'm the character I have in mind for the game that I'm working on is only humanoid from like the top up. There's like no legs or anything like that. And so I've been trying to figure out a way to change the animation rigs in Unity to sort of only allow for waist up. But so far I haven't really been able to figure that out. And so that got me thinking, like, why is humanoid such a staple in game characters? And, like, why is it that there's so many resources poured into making these humanoid characters look great, feel great, make them easy to implement in Unity? And mm-hmm. the only logical conclusion is that's because that's the expectations that players have. Players start with the mindset of, like, I'm playing as a human. Is that because we are primed to think in terms of human, like, we are humans, therefore things should be human? Maybe, but it's just this weird kind of concept that it feels like there's untapped potential to be a little bit more creative, like not make characters human. But there's also at the same time probably a reason why we make characters human so often. You know,
like humans, vehicles, like rollerballs, like even things like spiders, like, you kind of intuitively know, like, roughly how each of these things are going to move, and they're all completely different from one another. And so if you do encounter, you know, like a human that's only half human and some other, like, locomotion because they don't have legs, I would be interested to see, like, how that turns out with what you decide, like, feels best for that character, because mm-hmm. I would assume it would be a little bit different than, you know, more standard humanoid movement in games.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll figure it out. Hopefully at some point, maybe several decades from now, I will have a working prototype of movement. And I can share that with everyone. Yeah. All right. Well, what do you say we move on to our main topic here? We want to talk about procedural generation. Personally, I'm coming at this from an admittedly very narrow perspective, and therefore, because it's narrow, probably a somewhat antagonistic perspective, because when I hear procedural generation, my mind defaults to, and again, I have to emphasize, this is unfair. I know it's unfair, but that's what this episode's going to be. I'm going to learn, but my mind goes toward.
I am sharpening my pitchfork already.
My skin is very weak. You don't have to sharpen it much. Just it'll go right through. When I think of procedural generation, I think lack of creative. A lack of intentional design is what I think. So mm-hmm. when I hear like term roguelike, I know roguelike is it procedural generation is part of roguelike. It's part of other things, which we'll talk about. But like, again, my dumb brain goes from, I hear roguelike. I think, oh, those are procedurally generated levels, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a part of that because that's not a careful curation by an author, a creative director for a specific intent. And I want to fall into this specific intent. I want to experience this thing, carefully curated thing, and that's what I want to do. And so that's largely what's kind of put me off of any time I hear the term procedural generation, I wince. But that's what we're going to talk about because that's a narrow perspective. That can't be true. It can't be true. Not only because I've already read the notes that people have written here, so I know that's not true.
But I'm revising also, my notes to be a lot meaner right now.
Let's maybe talk about like what it is and what it's not. And maybe I'll start with Charlotte. If someone says what is mm-hmm. procedural generation, what would you say to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my initial thought is like what you've just described, I think is probably a pretty, I don't know if it's common, but I could definitely see that being something that people commonly think of with like what they assume to be procedural generation. But I think it belies kind of like the difference between procedural generation and random generation. And so what you described of like having no like crafted part of that experience, that to me, does seem more like random generation, where you've got all of these things in there, like all these possibilities, and you're just going to kind of let them be what they will be. Like the computer will determine this is our output this time. But with procedural generation, and Nash, please jump in if I get any of this wrong, because like you're, I think, very familiar with procedural generation stuff, or I'm like a dabbler in it. Procedural generation to me has more of a crafted part of it. It's not crafted obviously to the degree that a like say very linear game would be, where every moment of that experience has been scripted and designed. But with procedural generation, it's more like I've created a lot of different options or variations for this particular like iteration or situation or area, and within those the computer is going to select from like predetermined options, and then it's going to kind of move from there. And so it's sort of that like middle balance between completely random generation and like fully designed and crafted every moment of that experience.
I think it's kind of interesting that you make a distinction between procedural and random generation, because I guess to me, I guess I just kind of think about it maybe as like a broader spectrum of like the difference between static and dynamic content, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I guess like, I mean, pure randomness, purely human, purely human curated and authored content, and then even like a more algorithmic deterministic, sorry about my bird.
That's all right.
Kiwi. So
the bird doesn't like procedural generation either.
No, he hates it, but he hates all video games. But yeah, so like I guess I just kind of consider all of these sort of points on this, like maybe not even a spectrum, maybe even kind of more dimensional than that, but like this realm of like the difference between static and dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess one of the things that comes to mind for me is like how rule-based is it, and what are those rules? Because they can become very complex and have like rules within rules. Like one of the things that I played with previously was like procedurally generating plants, and there are like algorithms that are designed to basically represent, hey, this is a way to define like how plants grow in real life. Like it's a lot of like fractals essentially. And whenever you're using one of these models, they're called L systems, like the letter L. You use different letters to represent like different changes like per iteration. So you tell it to, you tell your algorithm to run so many times, so many iterations. And as it goes through, it builds this plant based off these letter rules that tell it things like, this is how long or how wide this thing should be. And is this thing a stem or is it a leaf? And you can, in this set of rules, you can only have leaves after stems, or you might tell it that like, hey, this is a really weird plant and there are no stems. It's like only leaves, and you're going to probably get like a leaf ball or like something that looks more like a vine. And yeah, I love things like that where you basically go in and tell it like, hey, you are going to be random. Like, don't get me wrong. You're going to run differently every time unless you are purposefully reusing whatever like random math seed was used to kick off all of the randomization. I find it fascinating to see that sort of thing. That's just like an example for plants and how different all the different like outcomes can be with that is pretty fun.
Some plant-based content.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't ever messed with L systems. That's cool though.
It's neat. I used that for my game Sprouts. It's the game that's not actually a game. It is like a plant growing simulator. And so L systems are used to grow those plants. And it's probably a horrifically bastardized L system. Like after I built it, I found like much smarter resources. And by that time I was like, oh my God, I'm done. Like I need to put this game away, but they can become incredibly complex and you can make some incredible plants out of things like that.
One of the things that came to mind when you were talking about this, I think is probably like the first sort of the first recognition of me and my narrow-mindedness is the idea that random generation can be used in asset creation, not necessarily in full experience creation. So it's a matter of, you know, I know me as like a creative director, for example, I know that this level needs trees in this particular spot, right? Like that's a conscious decision I'm making as a creative director. I need these trees to be here because I want to lead the player here. I want to project a sense of life or a forest-like environment or something. So that's my vision.
Mm-hmm.
But how to make the tree itself, why not speed things along or help things look a little bit more organically by using these algorithms to create these random, these procedurally generated trees. Now, the unfair person in me, the person who was saying, no, but see, if I'm a really good creative director, I should have a reason for this tree having this many number of leaves pointed in this direction. And that's absurd, right? That's absurd. But like, so that's my own problems with like needing to say like how carefully curated does the experience need to be before I'm satisfied?
What degree of control do you need over it?
Yeah. And what degree do I demand as a player before I'm like, that's an official game now?
It's absurd. Not to open that can of worms.
Wait, this pencil was made by a machine? This is an art. Handmade pencils only.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. Like thinking about it, like the uses for procedural generation might be worth talking a little bit about, right? Like asset creation is great. Like what other things could maybe is procedural generation used for in games that maybe idiots like me aren't really thinking about?
I would definitely say like level generation is going to be a pretty common one. I mean, they use that with Valheim, that every world is procedurally generated and it's going to be unique, you know, whenever you create a new world. Minecraft, again, another good example of that. Nash and I worked on Tracer together, and we used procedural generation to create the like course that you're racing down, it as well as to populate the different like hazards that you have to avoid in that. I definitely think that like level generation is a very common one, and like you don't have to make obviously your entire game like procedurally generated. You can absolutely like mix and match different things in there, just completely depending on what sort of game you're trying to make. And you might even have areas that are like procedurally generated levels and then other areas that are not. Like I can kind of think of like a hub world where that is pretty stable. That is a very like crafted, bespoke experience and area, but once you leave the hub world, perhaps it's all generated one way or another. I think Loop Hero is like that. I could be wrong about the hub world aspect of it, but from what I recall, it's kind of like that.
One of the like action rogue-lite, I guess, games that I have played in the past is like the Torchlight series, and they kind of do that. Like they're like town areas are just like a constant map, and then the rest of the areas are kind of procedurally generated. And I think they use sort of like a chunk system where they like design pieces of the level, and then they have an algorithm that like combines pieces to make the whole level.
I know Spelunky is like that, and they kind of use that to always guarantee there's a path through. So even within you know, the level generation, there are rules on rules, because it's like these are the chunks, these are the chunks available during this you know, set of worlds. They'll have like different themes, like this is the jungle area, for instance. And then within that, how those chunks get selected and laid out has a series of rules to determine what's going to go where, and that it's actually possible. It might be diabolical, but it's technically possible.
Yeah, Spelunky is a great example, actually. And the creator, Derek Yu, wrote a book on it, and it's an incredible book, but he goes specifically into the randomized levels, and this actually is worth calling out again, me playing the role of the naysayer, but thinking in terms of random generation not being subject to the whims of a computer necessarily, but still it's informed by artistically driven rule sets by the creator. So the creator is still telling the system, these are the things that I want you to be able to do. And I felt it was cool because I'll read a few of them off here, but you had four specific rules that he wanted to make sure that his level generation system followed. These were things that it had to, like whatever algorithm he wrote, these things had to be part of it. And the first one was level start at an entrance door at the top of the level and end at an exit door at the bottom. So the reverse to that would be like, well, why wouldn't there be a level that starts at the bottom and works its way to the top, right? And that's a conscious artistic choice, right? Like there's a sense of digging deeper, of going down, that would be completely contradicted by going up, you know? And there's probably other reasons he did that. I'm sure there's like, you know, it probably makes various traps easier, like spikes on the floor are more threatening if you're constantly going down as opposed to going up. So there's probably something else there, but I think that's really cool to think about in terms of like, yeah, okay, I want to make sure that the player has a sense of going deeper always. Number two, there must be a way to get from the entrance to the exit without using bombs, rope, or any special items. Anything not on this path can be walled off or otherwise inaccessible. But there, and this speaks to what you were saying, Charlotte, about there has to be a path through that you can do without having to have any special equipment or special items that might, that they themselves are randomly generated to some degree. So like there has to be a guarantee that you can actually make it through. That seems very logical. That seems a very practical rule set to put in there. Number three, the level generator must do its best not to create any places where the player can get stuck and have to use items to get out. If such a place is created after level generation through terrain destruction, that's fine. So I don't have much to say on that one, just because I feel like it's trying to say something similar to what the second one was saying, is that, you know, you don't want the player to be able to get stuck. And then four, try to make the edges of the rooms as hard to notice as possible, but don't worry too much about that. And I thought that was cool, because that's another artistic choice to say, you know, we don't want the player to know. We don't want it to be a Legend of Zelda, on the NES dungeon where it's a single screen and you can see definitively the end of the level. Like, we want it to give the sense of infinite, like, possibilities and infinite scope. So it was cool that, you know, there was those things that were consciously written into there, which, again, it makes sense, you know, and it really helps to understand, like, how procedural generation can work to someone's advantage. Now, me, as of course, the resident naysayer, I would still say I would rather have a level that is curated for a very specific purpose and intent, but also that's probably just my aversion to a genre rather than sort of my aversion to a tool that's being used to create something. Like, maybe that genre just isn't for me, but it's still very valid.
If you really, if what you really want is a level that somebody deliberately laid out, then I mean, obviously you don't want one that's been procedurally generated.
Yeah. And I think that it's important to consider as a game designer, or certainly somebody who's like a level designer, but whenever you're making a game, like, this falls into the choose the right tools for the job, because, you know, you don't have to use procedural generation for any part of your game if you don't want to, but there might be times when that is a really good fit if you're making a game that supports it really well. So you have to, like, kind of balance and consider, you know, what is it that I'm making and why. And yeah, so, like, thinking again for something like Tracer, I don't think not using something like procedural generation would have been a good choice for that game, because it is something that I wanted to have a high degree of, like, replayability. I wanted it to be different every time somebody played the game. There's the whole component of how the music ties into the level that you're playing through. And if I had designed this, like, chorus that was exactly the same every single time you played it, it would make for a very different game, which maybe would have been awesome, but it wasn't the game that I wanted to make or play. And so procedural generation was a great fit, and I was able to create very fine-tuned controls and rules for, like, hey, these kinds of things can happen at these times during generation. You have to have these kinds of breaks between certain things. Like, the sets of hazards that you will encounter are very carefully selected, not only for each level, but for each sub-level in the game. There are, like, three sub-levels to a level, and certain things that, like, interludes almost between them. And for each of those segments, there's a very specific set of, hey, these kinds of things can be spawned into the game. They are allowed to have these particular patterns, and within all of those, we controlled, like, the frequency of them. So some would be more likely than others, and all of that kind of pulled together to create this, like, totally unique experience every time you play it, but you will still have a particular feel to each set of levels. Like, each one is a whole with a, like, beginning, middle, and end, and a unique set of like, objects, hazards that will be appearing within each one. And so, like, you can go in there and get, like, very, very detailed with it, but you also totally don't have to. But I think it worked well for Tracer.
Maybe what we can do now is talk a little bit about, so we've discussed what procedural generation is, what it can be used for. Maybe if we understood a bit more about the different types of procedural generation out there, it could help highlight use cases and sort of the reasons for it. There's quite a few that are listed here. I think, Nash, you probably added most of those. So maybe what I'll do is allow you to sort of talk through some of these types or methods for procedural generation, the ones that you're most comfortable talking about. Talk us through, like, just some different types of procedural generation and maybe what their use case is.
One of the simplest ones is just, like, basic random variation, which is, like, you know, you say this could happen or maybe this could happen at a certain point, and then you just tell the computer to choose one of those, and then maybe it's not just two choices, maybe it's 5 or 10. So, which is kind of like in Tracer, I assume, Charlotte, that you have a set number of, like, patterns that each chunk of the level can be, and so you're choosing one of these things. So there's some curation there. You are creating individual components, and then you're just combining them randomly.
Mm-hmm.
I recognized several of the letters you put in there, but the words themselves, when put together, I didn't recognize all of them. So I did look. I did look a few of them up, and I thought there were some cool ones. Like Perlin Noise was one that I had never. This was the one that sort of clued me into thinking it in terms of asset creation.
Yeah.
Because if I understand correctly, Perlin Noise feels like a way to sort of make things that look organic. It's following the rule set that if you were to apply, mathematical equations to how things look in nature, this is in some ways trying to replicate that to some degree. Is that accurate or is that way off?
Yeah. It makes like a very distinct kind of like cloudy, fuzzy textured kind of noise, like static noise. And you're absolutely right about the asset creation, because they've been using Perlin Noise for like decades to make assets and like textures in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure, I think Blender has like, you can just generate a Perlin Noise texture on the fly to use for things.
Yeah, I know ShaderGraph in Unity has that, and it gets used for, clouds, waves, generating terrain, like anything that has like that static to like a smooth wavy look, depending on like the frequency that you set it to. Perlin Noise can be a really good option for it.
It just sort of hit me too that procedural generation also, to me, when I use the term, I always think in terms of the finalized asset. This asset was created through procedural generation, or this level was created through procedural generation, but even the small micro steps that go into creating the asset itself are procedurally even just general noise filters, or in Blender when you use like the non-destructive, I think they're modifications, is that what they're called, mods or something like that?
Yeah,
like the non-destructive versions of those are themselves things that are procedurally generated to then apply to your model, which then become a full asset, which then go into the game. So you're using these micro steps, whether you realize it or not, you're using procedural generation probably for things that you would not sell as this is a procedurally generated game.
And really, speaking of Blender, like people, there's a lot of people out there who are using the geometry nodes in Blender to make just really amazing procedural things, like say an apartment building, and then you can drag a slider and it's like 4, 5, 6 stories, however, and then you add, make it 6 windows wide, 10 windows wide, and it can even do, maybe it's throwing some balconies in there, or like an awning or that kind of thing. It's very cool, just making it dynamic in this way. Another cool one, and Caleb, you actually like corrected me on the name for this, because I always think of it as waveform collapse, which I think is like the quantum physics term. And the person who made up this procedural generation algorithm, they were inspired by that. But this is called wave function collapse. And it's basically like you sample something. An image is the example that they usually use, but you could also use like a tile map for your level. You're sampling some kind of like 2D grid generally, and you're looking at each square, and then you're looking at the squares around it. And so like you're saying, oh, okay, this is an island tile and everything around it is water. And so then you kind of record that in a statistical, like a probabilistic model. And then you take that model and then you just start over and you create a new tile map. And then you just like pick a square and set it at random. And then you go every square around it and you just go out until you've filled out the whole map using your model. And so it has rules that it's picked up from whatever it sampled, and it will make a similar but not identical end result.
That's cool. I haven't actually heard of that one.
Yeah, it's very neat.
When I was looking this up, and you totally didn't have to call out that I corrected you on it, because I genuinely thought maybe there was two separate things that were going on, and I wanted to make sure. And also, by saying that I corrected you, that implies that I know what I'm going to be talking about right now, and I absolutely do not.
Yeah.
So, but when I was looking up examples of it, a lot of the end results tended to look like a series of sort of interconnected like water pipes or something. So if you think in terms of like if I fed it like two tiles. One was a pipe, like a, just a, like a thing in terms of like a Mega Man aesthetic background level pipe. And also I fed it like a pipe with another pipe behind it that's perpendicular. It would spit out something that used those ideas, but broadcast it much larger to sort of build out this very interconnected network of pipes, right? That you might see as sort of ground texture in a 2D platform or something like that. But it looks, it's varied, but it's only using these small seed sort of icons. Or if you think of like a, if you're looking at the map in like a Super Metroid or something, and you see like the mini map and it's sort of rooms and canals and everything, you could feed it something, a couple of small tiles of that, and it would spit out this randomly generated map that looks very detailed and curated and everything. And I definitely, when I was looking into that, I sensed there was some potential there, because if I'm approaching this from, again, like a heavy, like I want there to be like conscious curation, you could still start with this random generated map and then use the conscious creation to say, well, why would the player need to go into this randomly generated corner of the map? Like, yeah, that map was randomly generated, but now I can use artistic sensibilities to say, mm-hmm. what would cause the player to need to go there? How would the environment look on the actual like layout of the level itself to get the player to say, I need to go to that corner of the map that, you know, that maybe there's a locked gate or a locked door or something that the player needs to go back to, you know? So there's still like, you can apply that conscious curation after the fact of these randomly generated maps, which is a pretty cool concept, and that's something that I would absolutely love to like explore at some point.
That is really neat, because I do think like a lot of times you think about procedural generation in terms of like that's going to be in your final product, you know, so that it can generate something new every time. But you're right, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, you could do some procedural generation stuff just to draw inspiration on. Like, you could start with a map, and a wave function collapse map is kind of a good example for an opportunity there, because one of the problems with like generating, say, like your mini map with wave function collapse is that it generally uses like a fairly small amount of context. You know, it's like looking at one square and then everything around it. So it'll make patterns that make sense in a small area, but it's generally not a sophisticated enough model to look at like the bigger picture and say, like, you know, can you really, on this whole map, can you really get from the start point to the end point? Like, is there even a path there? It doesn't necessarily know that, but you could generate a map and then you would know that, and you could, you know, you could make some doors or some pathways and flesh it out.
With that in mind, is it limiting for publishers, just marketing people in general, to when they advertise their games as having procedural generation?
One of the main struggles there is just the, like, just both of those terms in a marketing context are so used, and like they really don't tell you a whole lot about what you're gonna get. You know, they can call it a roguelike, and it could really be almost anything.
Yeah,
they could say it's procedurally generated, and it could again almost be anything. And you don't know if it's good procedural generation or if it's just like a just chaotic mess, or you know, you just don't know.
Or like what part of it is procedurally generated, like that can make a huge difference.
Usually how I approach these things is, rather than fight against that marketing, the marketing copy, like there's a reason I think I hear people say something's roguelike. And to be honest, actually, it's probably not really the publishers that say it. It's probably the pundits and the critics and stuff that say it. So it's, you know, I'm probably unfairly, you know, putting the blame on the publisher's shoulders. But yeah, when I hear that term, like, it implies just something about, it's basically like a stand-in for, this is a game that has random generation in it.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've discussed here, lots of games could have varying degrees of random generation, so it probably doesn't ultimately mean anything other than, this is going to be a game that is different every time you play it. That's probably what it boils down to, is this is going to be different every time you play it. That's what we say when we say, that's what we mean when we say roguelike, and therefore, and on you go.
Yeah, I think it's important to ask yourself, like, what and why with procedural generation? And you should be doing that, like, as a game designer, if you're working on like the marketing side, making sure that you're properly describing, like, if there's something like procedural generation, like, well, what is it? Because by itself, that doesn't honestly mean much. As a player, same thing. Like, if you're going to be like turned off by procedural generation, like, will you have that reaction for all of the same kinds of things? So, like, again, thinking about like procedural generation that might have been used to create assets versus like the level or terrain versus items versus like plot or narrative. Like, there's so many different things in each of those, if they are procedurally generated or not, and how, will obviously have a pretty big impact on what that game is like. And procedural generation by itself, I kind of see more as like a tool than a feature, because like by itself, it honestly doesn't mean much. It's like, it's all about, well, what is it and how did you use it?
That's a good way to think about it. Yeah, it's a tool, not a feature necessarily.
Yeah.
With edge cases, of course. I mean,
sure.
In some instances, it would be a feature, but like for the most part, yeah, it's a tool, and it's a tool that a lot of developers probably don't even realize that they are using, as I alluded to earlier. You know, when I'm using a texture generation tool, I mean, that's what I'm doing. So that's interesting. Well, before we move on to the game, which I do want to make sure we leave some time here to play a game, I want to talk through, I want to give an opportunity to talk a little bit more about any examples and approaches by, you know, by the two of you in procedural generation. I know we talked a bit about Tracer already. You talked a little bit about Sprouts, Charlotte. But I don't want to necessarily close off the conversation to those, because I think there are some interesting, cool things being done there. So I definitely want to give both of you the opportunity to sort of talk through uses of procedural generation in your games.
Yeah, I made a game called Transmutations, and it's I don't know if you would call it procedurally generated, maybe. Because see, like, where you, Caleb, you very much value kind of artistic curation in a piece. You know, you want to play a game that someone wanted to make this game, you know, like, and experience what they created. And I'm kind of like, in a lot of ways, on the other end of the spectrum, because I'm like, I want to see some chaos, you know. I want to see something that nobody has ever seen before, and I want to see if it even can hold itself together. So I do some, like, I always get into these things where I'm like messing around with some really weird stuff. So Transmutations is actually just like basically a cellular automata that it creates, well, I guess I should explain what a cellular automata is.
Yeah, for the listener, I mean, I'm fine, but yeah.
It's, gosh, how do you even explain it? It's like a math thing. It's like you have a 2D grid, and you have squares on it, and they can be different colors. We'll say colors, but, and based on what color they are, they can change. Then it creates all these weird patterns.
It's like they influence their neighbors, is that right? Like,
yes,
yeah, like they influence their neighbors. It applies the influence, and then each step it applies the influence, and it kind of like grows from there.
You have some kind of very deterministic rules for what each thing becomes based on its situation.
Mm-hmm.
So Transmutations creates a new cellular automata each time you play, and then it that's the puzzle. Like, you have to figure out how to work it. And then I've also made a platformer using cellular automata to generate the levels, which I don't recommend. It's not a good way to generate levels, because they're so hard to control. And I didn't finish that game, but maybe I will someday. I think it has potential. It's not going to be a fun game, but if you want to play a platformer where you're jumping and climbing on a cellular automata, then I think this could do it for you.
That would be the niche.
Yeah. It's like the five people in the world who want to do that, you know?
I love any game that's described as, it doesn't work, but you should play it. Like,
that is very exactly much my thing of like, there's something very wrong here. Let's check it out. I'm in.
Yeah, I'm in too, I think.
Yeah.
Is Transmutations available for play on your itch.io page or anywhere else?
Yeah, it's on itch.io. And actually, like, so it's another game where it's like, you know, does it really work as a game? It's hard to say. It's kind of obtuse. It's hard to figure out. I did do the math one time, and I figured out kind of like a meta strategy for at least the first couple of turns. So the other thing I did with Transmutations is I was like, this isn't terribly fun as a puzzle, but I added some music to it, so it's kind of like a chill procedural music thing, mostly.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. Well, I'll definitely make sure that that's linked. If you're listening, it'll be linked in the show notes, along with Sprouts and along with Tracer as well, for sure. Well, I don't know about you two, but I learned something today. I learned that I should appreciate random generation more so than I did in the past. And I also learned, this is future Caleb speaking. I also learned that I'm still in the lead in this quiz that we do every episode. Now, Nash, this is your first time, assumedly not your first time listening, but definitely your first time being a part of this. Every episode, we have a little quiz here, little quiz. You, the two of you work together. You're on a team versus me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you guys feel free to talk out loud, try to ruminate on the answers to these impossible questions. They're not that impossible. And today we're going to play a game called Concatenation, which is a game that we have played before. And basically this is a game in which I give you the name of a famous video game brand, and you tell me what are the two words that make up this well-known brand or product, even in some cases. Basically, what's the portmanteau that made this thing? So, for example, if I were to ask, Nintendo's breakout Japanese home gaming system is referred to as the Famicom, which would be launched as the Nintendo Entertainment System outside of Japan. Famicom is a mashup of what two words? You would say...
I think it's the family computer. Is that right?
The family computer.
Yes, that is correct. Oh, that's what you would say. Does this one count?
We'll see. I'm usually pretty
example
lenient,
point.
So maybe. I did only have exactly five, five questions. I didn't have any extras. So if you find fault in any of my questions, which very well could be the case, then maybe we will be able to rely on that one as a thing. I can't remember what the score is. I'm terrible. I think maybe I was one ahead.
That sounds right.
What? This is episode five, right?
Yes.
Yeah, five. So it was probably like
one to three.
Three to two? Okay.
Oh, wait. Yeah, if this is
well, because if it was four episodes, then it would have to be... Yeah, we'll say two to two, but I don't know. I'll figure it out. It'll be in the show notes. I think I was still ahead, but I don't know. We'll see. This one, I think, will put you either even or ahead of me because there are some here that are maybe easy. I don't know. I say that every time. And then I end up looking like a jerk because then you guys don't get it. And I'm like, but they were easy. Okay, so let's start with the first one here. Intellivision. The Intellivision is a home video game console released by Mattel Electronics in 1979. The name is a portmanteau of what?
Ooh. Intelligent television.
Yep.
Yay.
That is correct.
Nice.
All right. You're off to a good start here. All right. Activision Publishing Inc. is an American video game publisher based in Santa Monica, California. It serves as the publishing business for its parent company, Activision Blizzard. I don't even like saying that word, but here we are.
Yep.
And consists of several subsidiary studios. Activision is one of the largest third-party video game publishers in the world and was a top United States publisher in 2016 and assumedly now, I don't know. What is the portmanteau of Activision?
I don't actually know. I'm trying to think of what it could be.
And I'm re-looking it up right now because I forgot to put the answer down. There we go. Okay. I'll give you a hint. One of the words is the same as from the previous question.
Yeah, I was thinking television. It's hard to think of other things that would work for vision.
Action?
Like visionary. Action? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that would fit.
Yeah.
Or just active.
Oh,
active television.
Interactive? Is it... What was the first one? Intelligent?
Intelligent television. Yeah.
I'm leaning towards interactive television. Nash, what do you think of that?
I feel like it wouldn't have the inter.
No? Not for making, like, software that you interact with? Or do you think it's more active as in...
Like active or action, I think.
Mm.
I don't know. I just don't know that if it would be a portmanteau if it like if it chopped off the front, you know.
Oh, does that count?
Oh, I will say, okay, that's actually a great comment. Portmanteau, I probably used very restrictively. So there could possibly be some in which it's not truly the first part of one word. This particular case is not that. So I'm giving you a bit of a hint, but I didn't want there to be confusion moving forward. So yeah, it could be variations a little bit. So
Nash, let's go with one of yours.
Maybe active to be safe.
Yeah. Active television.
Active television.
Yeah.
You are correct.
Yay! Hey.
Yay.
Nice.
Formed when three Atari All-Stars left because the new CEO, Ray Kassar, basically was pretty restrictive on the credit that the developers could get, not letting the developers put their names in the games, not letting anyone tell them what kind of games they worked on. It was basically a way to say we don't want our star developers to be poached by other people.
Wow.
It was really, really bad. And so Atari was kind of the first company Activision was formed by three people who left that company to form a company that they wanted to be very, very developer focused. And a lot of their early games, like they went 180 degrees and we're like, this is who made this. And it's like, there's pictures of them like on the covers and stuff. Like they went really crazy, which was cool. It was cool to see. All right. Okay. The next one, this one I will say has a bit of a, there's two versions of this online that I could find of how this name came about. So I will accept either one.
Okay.
Ubisoft. I don't have any fun flavor text to add to that, but Ubisoft, what words make up Ubisoft?
I guess the last one's probably software.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is correct. Yes. Yes.
Ubi.
Well, in one of the two versions. Yes. I think, wait, nope. Oh, in both of them. Nope. In both of them. Software. Yeah.
It's not like soft serve. Like
there's no ice cream company.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be the weirdest thing. There's been ColecoVision, Connecticut Leather Company.
Right. So.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
What would Ubi be?
Ubiquitous?
Oh, I like that. I want to go with it just because I like the idea of ubiquitous software.
Okay.
Let's do that.
You are correct. Ubiquitous software is one of them, yes. The other that would have been accepted is apparently the brothers who started the company and are still, I guess, the leaders, that E. Sevon and some other dude. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Anyway, they are from, I guess, an area in France or around France called the Union de Breton Independence. So UBI. That seems almost like too coincidental. I think maybe that is the original reason. And then later on, they were like, let's instead say it stands for ubiquitous software because that's funner
maybe
to market.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Cool.
Okay.
Universal basic income software.
Can we?
Yeah, right.
I would like that, please.
So, so either you have two more and you've got the first three. So no matter what, you're going to win this round.
Yeah.
But we're going to keep going because it's fun. Hasbro Incorporated is an American multinational conglomerate with toy, board game, and media assets headquartered in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hasbro owns the trademarks and products of Kenner, Parker Brothers, Milton Bradley, among others. Hasbro is the shortened version of what?
Pretty sure Bro is Brothers.
That sounds
Bros
right.
Is Brothers. Now you just have to know what their actual last name is.
I know. Is it Has?
Damn it. No, it's not.
shit. I don't know, like,
it's hard to even think of a last name that starts with H-A-S.
Yeah. Or ends in H-A-S, maybe.
I don't know if this is going to be helpful, but it looks like it might be sort of an anglicized German last name.
Ah.
So that narrows it down probably, right?
Ah, shit. I know essentially zero German, including names.
And to be fair, I don't know if it would help because I'm probably wrong when I say it looks like an anglicized German. I'm probably way off.
Yeah. Well, I don't know their name, but yeah, family name Brothers.
That would be way better if a company name.
Right? Family name Brothers.
Family name Brothers. Surname Brothers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I feel like you guys are giving
up. Haskell?
It is Hass. That part's correct.
Well, I figured that much. I have no idea.
Hassenfield. Hassenfield Brothers.
I never would have got that.
I only assume Hassen from Hasselhoff, mm-hmm. and then Field, I think, is sort of Anglo.
Yeah.
But I don't know that for a fact. So.
Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... And if you would have said Hasselhoff Brothers, I probably would have given it to you.
Yeah.
It
would have been...
All right, last one. Namco was one of the world's largest producers of video arcade games, having published over 300 titles since 1978. Many of its games are considered some of the greatest of all time, including Pac-Man, Galaga, Xevious, Ridge Racer, Tekken, and Katamari Damacy.
Mm.
Namco got its name from the abbreviation of... And I will say it is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, with Co being company.
Okay, I was going to suggest a bunch of different things for Co. Gosh. Okay, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words.
Yeah. So one of those letters in Namco, which is spelled N-A-M-C-O, is actually, there's two words in a row that begin with the same letter, so they just sort of made it one letter in the abbreviation.
Oh my gosh.
And one of the words is a Japanese name, so I don't
know. Oh my gosh.
I'm not up on my Namco history. Yeah, I have no idea.
I was, this one was unfair, I'll be honest. It stands for Nakamura Amusement Machine Manufacturing Company.
Oh my gosh, I love amusement machine. That's cool.
Yeah, it's an amusement machine.
I'm very into that.
A lot of those old companies just have, like we were talking about on one of the episodes, Capcom, mm-hmm. Capsule Computer, because they wanted to try to get arcades to be called Capsule Computers. And so they have a lot of this, like, lineage from, like, just amusement days and, like, it's interesting stuff. So,
yeah.
Well, you handedly won that one. Even had you not gotten the first three correct, that last one I probably would have exchanged for the example question. So either way... you won. I wish I knew what the total was, but I do not. It'll be in the show notes if you, the listener, are interested. But so we talked about, I want to quickly recap, and then we'll give each of you the opportunity to tell people where they can find you online should you wish to be found. We talked about Valheim. We talked about Chess. I'll get it.
Yeah.
We talked about Nier Replicant. I brought up Sackboy again for some weird reason. We talked about Tracer, Charlotte's game, and Charlotte and Nash's game. Nash helped out with it, of course.
Yeah.
We talked about Sprouts. We talked about Transmutations, which all of those games will be listed in the show notes. If you want to go play them, you probably should. And I think those are the only games we talked about, right? I think so. The only ones we gave any sort of space to, I suppose.
Yeah.
Cool. So thank you all so much for listening. This has been a lot of fun for me. I hope a lot of fun for you listening, and I hope a lot of fun for the two of you, Charlotte and Nash. If you have any comments, you as in the listener, or I guess Charlotte and Nash, if you have comments too, you can follow the same process. If you have any comments on this episode or any Flyover Indies episode, reach out to us, tweet us at Flyover Indies, or email us at contact@flyoverindies.party. We might read your tweets or emails in a future episode. In terms of where you can reach, Charlotte, I will let you go first. Where can people reach you should you wish to be reached?
Yeah, you can track me down on Twitter. I am at CTRBLE.
And Nash, what about you?
Yeah, I'm also on Twitter. I'm, what is my name on there? It's Nash, N-A-S-H, underscore, hi, H-I-G-H. And, yeah, I don't know. That probably has a link to my website, which would have a link to everything else. So,
and you're in luck too, because as part of my standard process, I will read your website out because you made the freaking music that the listener might be listening to right now.
Oh yeah.
Or if they're not, they will be listening to very shortly, depending on how quickly I can get through this outro. But that's www.nashhigh.com. You can find links to probably all of your stuff there, I would imagine. And me, you can find me on Twitter at Caleb J. Ross, all one word, the letter J, not like a word J, Caleb J. Ross, or my website, same, www.calebjross.com. And there is a link, I know I keep referencing links, but there's also a link in the notes, in the show notes, to a tag on itch.io that has a lot of Flyover Indies games. So if you just kind of want to poke around and see what we're all about, there's plenty of them listed there. You can literally have full minutes of fun, I promise. Probably hours. So thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe if you haven't. You can subscribe anywhere. And we look forward to making more of these for both us and you. Bye!